day, everyone, and welcome to the National Immigration Forum Legal Immigration Press Call. Today's call is being recorded, and at this time, I'd like to turn the conference over to Jacinta Ma. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Good morning, and welcome to the National Immigration Forum and the National Foundation for American Policy Press Call. Last week at the White House, Senators Tom Cotton and David Perdue announced their new RAISE Act. This legislation seeks to dramatically reduce legal immigration, and it would implement a point-based immigration system to replace our current employer-sponsored visa system. Now, what's particularly important about this legislation is that it continues the debate about whether our immigration system should focus on bringing in the best and the brightest, and how do we define who's best for our country. It's shifting the focus of the current immigration debate to the legal immigration system, and that's a conversation we welcome. There's no question that we need to modernize our immigration system to address our country's economic needs, the needs of American workers and businesses. But we need to do that while still recognizing our country's family values. Today, the National Immigration Forum and the National Foundation for American Policy are releasing a paper which addresses the potential impact of a points-based immigration system on agriculture and other business sectors in America. And with that, let me please turn to our first speaker, Stuart Anderson, Executive Director of the National Foundation for American Policy and the author of the paper. Stuart?
Thank you, Jacinta. This study came about because of Ali Noorani, who heads the National Immigration Forum, who had the good idea to start working on point systems even before an actual proposal had emerged in Congress. As a result, this paper features a broad discussion of many key issues. The study includes a detailed examination of the Canadian and Australian immigration systems, interviews with attorneys and business people very familiar with those systems, and also a close look at the current economic situation of U.S. employers, which is where I'll start. The research found times are tough for companies looking for workers in sectors such as agriculture, construction, and others. Today, employers in these sectors cannot find enough workers, and many of the workers they do find are not in legal status and face possible deportation. A lack of workers in agriculture and construction can lead to job loss in complementary sectors. The Bureau of Labor Statistics projects a need for workers at all skill levels, and many of the fastest growing occupations in the U.S. require no formal schooling. The study analyzes the RAISE Act and its proposal to reduce immigration by 50%, eliminate most family categories, and replace current employment categories with a point system. The bill's large reduction in legal immigration would lower America's rate of economic growth. In fact, any bill cutting immigration would do so, since the two key elements of economic growth are productivity and labor force growth. Cutting legal immigration in half would reduce the rate of economic growth by an estimated 12.5% from its current projected level, according to Joel Prakken of Macroeconomic Advisors. The RAISE Act would also cause over 4 million people to be eliminated from family and employment-based immigration backlogs after waiting for many years. And establishing a point system in place of employer sponsorship would substitute the judgment of some lawmakers in place of hundreds of thousands of individual employers in America. One of the findings of the research is that there's no evidence that eliminating certain family categories will raise wages for U.S. workers, as some have alleged. While a key premise of establishing a point system is a perceived low education level of current legal immigrants, in fact, the skill level of immigrants is rising, and both recent immigrants and their children are more likely to graduate college than native-born Americans. Census data show 84% of individuals admitted legally to the United States between 2010 and 2014 had a high school degree or higher, notes the Migration Policy Institute. Moreover, only 7% of the children of immigrants have not completed high school and are not enrolled in school, according to Pew Research Center. And the census data show the number of immigrant college graduates rose 90% from 2000 to 2015. The U.S. already admits hundreds of thousands of people annually on, quote, merit through existing temporary and permanent visa categories. In other words, counting as skilled workers, only the approximately 140,000 new employer-sponsored immigrants ignores many of the professionals and researchers who work in America on temporary visas. I'll turn now to the findings on Canada and Australia, which should be of interest given the recent talk that these countries represent a model for the U.S. immigration system. Overall, I found vast differences between those systems and what advocates of a point system describe or have proposed in the U.S. First, the purpose of point systems in Canada and Australia is to attract more immigrants, not reduce legal immigration. Second, in Australia, the point system is not important for business immigration. It's designed to allow independent immigrants, those without job offers or not already working for an Australian employer. It does not replace the ability of employers to sponsor specific employees, such as the RAISE Act proposes. And in Canada, employers hire high-skilled foreign nationals primarily through temporary visas. Gaining permanent residence through the point system is usually closely tied to the applicant's prior work experience in Canada. I found a drawback to the Canadian system, which the current U.S. system shares. It is not easy for employers to sponsor workers without a college degree. The high level of legal immigration, not their point systems, is really the key defining characteristics of the Canadian and Australian immigration systems. Relative to the size of their populations, Canada and Australia admit 2 to 3 times as many immigrants each year as the United States. Canadian employers have often criticized the Canadian point system, and fixes have happened only because the Canadian government has unilateral authority to make the kind of quick changes to immigration policy that are not possible under our own laws and government structure. In fact, this is one of the key conclusions of the report, and which I'll close with. The separation of authorities between the legislative and executive branches of the U.S. government likely makes it impossible for any point system to work effectively in a manner similar to point systems in Canada and Australia, which, as you know, are governed by parliamentary forms of government. Canada and Australia and Australian immigration law is fundamentally different from U.S. law. The Canadian and Australian immigration systems operate under statutory authority that is extremely broad by U.S. standards, granting almost absolute authority to bureaucratic agencies under the authority of a prime minister to decide how many immigrants to admit annually and under what criteria. When problems arise, the immigration agencies in those countries can issue new rules with a speed and authority unimaginable in the United States. In contrast, it took nearly 20 years for U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services to publish a regulation on the American Competitiveness and Workforce Improvement Act. Moreover, all efforts at establishing a point system in the U.S. have involved attempts to lock in rigid criteria that could only be overturned by passing a new law, making them unworkable in an ever-changing real-world economy. The report notes that we need to balance our nation's need for workers who have different skills with family-based immigration. S-744, bipartisan legislation which passed the U.S. Senate in 2013, pointed in this direction. Our immigration system can be designed to increase the immigration of people with a high level of skills without either eliminating the ability of employers to sponsor individual employees or reducing family immigration. For example, Congress could eliminate the per-country limit for employment-based immigration categories, increase the number of green cards for employment-based immigrants, and establish a pilot project for an independent category of immigrants, such as in Australia, alongside existing family and employment categories. As the report notes, bipartisan efforts to identify workable solutions like these serve the interests of American workers and their families and will help our economy grow.
Thanks so much, Stuart. Our next speaker is an attorney, Peter Rakai, with Rakai LLP, and he is practicing law in Toronto, Canada, so we'll be able to give us a firsthand information about the Canadian point system. Peter?
Well, thank you very much. The Canadian experience obviously is and has been very different over the last 20, 30 years from the U.S. experience. And I might start off by saying that Stuart is absolutely right. The evolution of the Canadian system lends itself really to a parliamentary system where a great deal of power is ceded to the executive branch, and the Minister of Immigration has a great deal of power to change the immigration system. Really, the Immigration Act that Parliament passes gives very, very broad parameters as to sort of general objectives of the immigration system, but it's the regulations that really fill in the blanks and make it happen. And regulations allow, in turn, for lots of policies or ministerial instructions to make further changes in the system. So how this would be grafted onto a congressional system would be, I would imagine, extremely difficult. Canadian immigration in the 60s and early 70s looked a lot like American immigration does today, in the sense that in those days 60% or more, probably about 65 to 70% of our immigrants were based on family and greater family sponsorship, which included brothers, sisters, uncles, aunts, etc., and a small portion involved skilled immigrants. We introduced a point system in the 60s, but that was really in order to diversify our immigration, which at that time was based on white European immigrants sponsoring their white European relatives. And the point system provided some more objectified and diversified immigration system that wasn't really about attracting high-skilled human capital at the time. That occurred a little bit later, but certainly used the point system as the basis for this change. I would say the largest and biggest change came in the late 80s and early 90s, interestingly with a conservative government in Canada under Brian Mulroney. And he introduced two things. He pushed skilled immigration and he introduced big immigration. Big immigration meant that within 2 years of attaining power, he had virtually doubled the immigration levels in Canada to near where they are today. Subsequent regimes, liberal and conservative, have followed that big immigration policy, never really retracting or going back, always staying there or going ahead in terms of levels. He also introduced and pushed what the bureaucrats in the Department of Immigration always wanted, which was a more skill-oriented immigration. Hence, the point system was upgraded and redesigned to attract high-end skilled immigrants. And the era I call it the designer immigrant was introduced in Canada when a point system matched all sorts of different components of a skilled immigrant. And the short story is it didn't work as well as it should have. These immigrants who came during this period should have performed incredibly well. They didn't perform badly, but they, I would say, underperformed. The reason is that it's very difficult to sit down with a piece of paper and design the perfect immigrant who is, quote, going to hit the ground running, as the bureaucrats love to say. Educational backgrounds from different countries didn't match with Canadian educational backgrounds. English language was good. It had to be good, but not good enough necessarily to operate in a professional background. Occupation lists were published, which had hot occupations, and these were the occupations of the future. By the time these occupation lists were published and the immigrants, which took 2 or 3 years to process their applications, arrived, these occupations were always out of date and never really in sync with a rapidly changing skilled labor market. So basically, it was not hooking up skilled, smart people with the actual Canadian labor force needs of the day. So after this experiment, and this type of point system seems to me to look a lot like the RAISE point system that Cotton and Purdue are coming up with, so the early iteration of the Canadian high-end immigrants, this system gave way to what is now the Federal Express Entry Program. And the Express Entry Program is all computerized, and it still works on a point system. But essentially what happened was this. Watching all the so-called designer immigrants not get jobs, the politicians and bureaucrats also saw that we had a robust, skilled foreign worker program, a temporary foreign worker program. And just as we were wondering how we could find that perfect point system to develop the perfect immigrant right for the labor force, we were asking skilled immigrants who were temporary foreign workers to go home after 2 or 3 or 4 years. And it finally, I think, dawned on the Canadian government to say, you know, these people who come here as successful, skilled, temporary foreign workers are and have hit the ground running. They're already on the ground. They're already running. These are the people we should be giving precedence to. So the Canadian system shifted, and while we continue to have a point system that looks at all different components, the point system relies very heavily on people who, A, already have jobs in Canada, which are skilled, not unskilled jobs, and or people of future job offers in Canada, and or people who have university or college degrees in Canada. Most of those have the ability to work for 2 or 3 years in Canada on post-grad work permits. So one or all of these components form the successful immigrant today that get enough points under our point system. To be without any Canadian connection, without any labor market connection, or without a Canadian higher-end education, it's a very big leap to get enough points under the current express entry system. So now basically we're looking at, you know, we're inviting people in still at high numbers and somewhat higher numbers now, 300,000, as opposed to earlier 280, 270. And this represents just under 1% of our population of 35 million. Obviously, per capita, a much larger number of immigrants than the United States is bringing in right now. But the conclusions of the Canadian system are this. It works when it is matched directly to the labor force, which means it works best when people already here who have already been admitted are allowed to stay. Two, it makes no impact unless there's large numbers. The concept not only is to get skilled people for the labor force, but to shift demographics. More young people, more young taxpayers. If you bring in small numbers, it's not going to move the numbers much. So there has to be a certain level of immigration, probably at least what we have today and probably more than what we have today in Canada. Three, to be implemented and to move with the times, it works best under a system that's controlled by the executive and not by Parliament or, in your case, by Congress. And finally, we've done one other thing that emerged in the 90s and after. We've diversified geographically our immigration. The federal government now allows a certain percent of economic immigrants to be chosen by the 10 provinces and 3 territories of Canada. And they are all eager always to get higher numbers. And the basis of their selection is pretty much the basis of the federal selection, is which they rely heavily on their local employers to pick people, ask to keep them, and those are the people who become provincial nominees who the federal government then turns into immigrants. So that's the evolution of the Canadian system, and that's where we are today. Thanks very much.
Great. Thank you so much, Peter. Next, we'll turn to Craig Regelbrug, who's the Senior Vice President of American Hort, and he will be talking about the impact of a points-based system on the agricultural industry. Craig?
Thank you, and thank you very much, and good morning, everybody. First, stating the obvious, American agriculture relies very strongly on immigrant labor, and that's not a new phenomenon. It's been the case for more than a century. It's estimated that roughly half or even more of farm workers producing things like grapes and strawberries and milk are not legally authorized to work in the U.S., yet they're making essential contributions to America's economy and our national well-being. In terms of visa programs, the agriculture sector primarily uses H-2A visas for seasonal workers, and we've seen fast-changing patterns with H-2A where demand has now become so intense that the number of visas issued has more than doubled in the last 5 years, from 65,000 up to about 134,000. We expect the Labor Department, by the end of this fiscal year, September 30, will certify roughly 200,000 agricultural job opportunities to be filled by an H-2A worker. It's sort of interesting that H-2A has no annual cap, but the visa process has long been cumbersome, and sometimes it's difficult for employers to gain the approvals that they need in time for peak seasons. And in agriculture, there's no room for waiting. It results in severe economic harm when your dates of need cannot be met. We're, of course, advocating for reforms that would streamline and simplify that program, and that's a key piece of the solution, though not the whole solution. While historically the bulk of labor needs in ag have been seasonal, the workforce is changing as the industries are changing. Many jobs are now longer duration. The phenomenon known as follow the crop migrancy is almost a thing of the past. Virtually nobody is coming in anymore across the border unauthorized seeking work in the sector. And the immigrants that are already here working in the sector have in many cases filled workforce gaps in positions of advancing skill and responsibility. And so even though these folks do not have advanced degrees, we see them as the career ladder, and they have critical skills, and their contributions are vital. In agriculture, immigrants and temporary workers are really more complementary than they are competitive with U.S. workers, and this is because they enable production of high-value crops and products here in the United States. And when we're producing here, that means we are also stimulating the creation of mostly American job opportunities that exist off the farm but are tied to the production. And these jobs sustain rural communities literally coast to coast. So we are a little concerned. We're obviously interested in watching closely, but proposed legislation which would reduce the number of workers without college degrees who can get here could further complicate hiring in the ag sector. And the agriculture sector really needs more rather than fewer flexible options for employment-based immigration and work visas. And I want to underscore that includes options, and based on what Peter just said, that includes options for those who already have work experience here to be able to be sponsored in some form or format and to be able to continue to contribute. Look forward to any questions that you have.
Thanks so much, Craig. And our final speaker this morning will be Laura Reif, who is a shareholder with the Greenberg Traurig Law Firm, and she is also the chair of our board of directors for the National Immigration Forum. Laura.
Thank you, Jacinta, and thanks for having me on today. I think this is an important discussion. It's a discussion that's been happening for decades now, our dysfunctional immigration system. And I think it's pretty obvious that our current economic growth in this country would not be where it is right now without an immigrant labor force. We see this point system kind of being put out there in isolation when we probably need to focus more holistically on the real problems of immigration. I know there's a focus on merit-based immigration in the United States with this administration, but we need to know how we defined merit. You just heard Craig Revelberger talk about agriculture. I think agricultural sustainability in the United States is certainly merit, is merited, and agricultural workers, I would argue, are merit-based immigrants. Again, our economic boom has been enabled by immigrants who come here to service all kinds of sectors, from high-skilled to low-skilled to no-skilled, in agriculture, in our medical services, hospitals, nursing homes. We see people who have temporary protected status playing a very important role in construction and in nursing care. Deferred action kids playing a real role in our workforce, and other foreign-born nationals who are here maybe in an kind of a destabilized kind of status, but are playing a real key role and are embedded in our workforce. So a point system alone is not really going to solve our workforce needs, especially a point system that is skewed the way this system seems to be skewed. We're already facing labor shortages, and it's anticipated that there will be a labor shortage of more than 7.5 million people by 2020. What we really need to do is focus on how we fuel our economy, allow for greater growth, and deal with the inadequacies of our current system. We can call it merit-based. A lot of immigrants that come in and work in nursing homes, I would argue, are also very merit-based. But there's no visa type. There's no category for many of what we like to call essential workers or semi-skilled or lesser-skilled workers. So when a business needs employees and can't find them and has tested the market, done the welfare-to-work issues, pays well above prevailing wage, and can't find workers, we have to have a mechanism to bring workers into this country. And if you look at the point system that's been proposed, that doesn't really address a wide swath of our economy and our industries. So I think what we need to do is really balance our need for workers who have different skills with our family-based immigration and our other immigration to make sure that we have something that suits our economy and suits our nation. It's also important to keep in mind that family unity has always been a core American value, and our American values as well as our economic realities steer us away from restricting family immigration, something that's proven to be cost-effective and kind of a safety net for immigrants over the years. I think I'll just wait and see if we have any questions.
Thanks so much, Laura. And so now we will open the line for questions. Operator, could you please let people know how to get in the queue?
Yes. If you would like to ask a question, please press the star key followed by the digit 1 on your touch-tone phone. And also make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. And we do ask that you limit yourself to one question, and then you may re-queue for any additional questions. And we'll take our first question today from Maria Pena with Law Opinion. Please go ahead.
Yes, good morning, and thank you for doing this call and the report. I was wondering, I went through the report, and I unless I missed it, I didn't see what steps, if any, the business sector is doing to push back against the bill. Obviously, as you mentioned, most sectors would be impacted by the RACE Act. And I was wondering if you had a sense, if you contacted business groups and lobbying groups, and what has been their response? Is there an action plan to push back against this? I mean, it's going to hurt the economy, the consumers, the workers. So what's the plan? What's the plan at this point? Thank you.
This is Stuart. Well, obviously, the paper is meant to be much broader, and it was in the works prior, but there's includes an analysis of the RACE Act. I mean, the purpose of the paper was not sort of to lay out a game plan for dealing particularly with the legislation, but really more to point out here's the likely impact. And I would expect, from having, interviewed business people before and analyzed similar types of impacts that you would see on a point system, that even, areas that we haven't even talked about yet, like healthcare, nurses would probably be almost impossible for like a nurse to get through any type of point system, because they tend to have an undergraduate degree. So I would expect that were something to move forward, you would get lots of business people. I know the business community didn't support back in 2007 when there was a point system put in a bill, because it, again, cut out employers completely from the process and would have had really a lot of very strange results and really given no certainty to whether or not a valued employee could ever be able to stay long-term in the U.S.
And once again, if you do have a question, please press star 1 on your touch-tone phone. And we'll take a question from Pilar Marrero with Law Opinion. Please go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for the call. I wanted to ask you, because the last speaker mentioned family immigration and how important it is, and the way this bill changes family immigration and shortcuts some of the family reunification, will probably have an effect in the economy. I would like someone to expand on that if possible. I'm talking about, cutting out, parents and siblings and others who were able to sponsor before.
This is Stuart again. I mean, the paper talks about how, overall, when you lower immigration levels, and it has some numbers in there, you're going to get less economic growth because labor force growth is an important feature of it, of economic growth. And what you're pointing to is other impacts that may not be so obvious in the statistics, possibly things like family-owned businesses, so entrepreneurship is obviously a key ingredient in an economy. Obviously, you would get much less of it. Immigrants are very entrepreneurial. And there are other impacts. There have been other research that even an immigrant with less, a college degree, if that person is able to help a family out and another that may allow another person, that they're working for, be able to to enter the workforce and use their skills. So there would be a variety of impacts, but Laura and Craig might have additional impacts that they would be thinking of.
Hi, this is Laura. I think I would just add that because of the demand in our current workforce right now, we've seen family immigration kind of help sustain business needs. So the studies have shown, including some that Stuart Anderson has written, that family immigrants don't become burdens on society. They don't go into the welfare system. They, in fact, are folks that who invest in the United States, create jobs, may have their own businesses, and may actually go into the workforce. And in this type of economy where we have an administration that's shooting for 3-4% growth, cutting off any type of legal immigration and, you know, diminishing it is going to be problematic for our economy.
And we'll pause again for just a moment for any additional questions. And once again, that is star one.
And great. And while we're waiting, you know, Craig, I just wanted to get your sense of whether you think that these kinds of proposals about merit-based systems or point systems, is this something that's good for the immigration reform debate?
Well, I think it's fair to say that all of us have our own perspectives based on our own experience and the interests, you know, the sectors that we're representing. You know, and so we're not all necessarily of one view about the right answer here, but I do think that many of us would broadly agree that we ought to be trying some new things, and perhaps we should be adjusting somewhat how our immigration system functions toward the national interest. I found it very interesting to listen to what Peter had to say, that if I heard you correctly, Peter, one of the best indicators of success in the Canadian system is, you know, somewhat of a proven track record, an established relationship with an employer where success has already been demonstrated to some degree. And I think we have an incredibly good opportunity in agriculture to try to get out of the mindset that it's all about temporary workers who are coming here seasonally and never have a chance to permanently immigrate legally. I think as our employment opportunities evolve, there is a similar great opportunity to be able to work together, employer and employee, to advance folks and to embrace them as ultimately as full-fledged members of our society, rather than being stuck in this temporary workers only forevermore mindset. So I do think there are tremendous opportunities to adjust the system in some places. And we ought to be looking at what our neighbors are doing and what some of the best and brightest countries in the world are doing in this space. The legislation that we're looking at today is not, as presented, the answer that's needed.
Stuart, it's Peter. Just to confirm, you're absolutely right about, you know, basing Canadian immigration at least on people who are already here. In 2000, and I guess the end of 2015, there was an early empirical study done by the department on the new Express Entry program and who was making it under the program, who was getting in. They found that 80-85% of the people being invited to apply in the Express Entry program, in other words, people who met the criteria, were people who were already here and working in Canada. So just to give you an idea of how much the system now relies on people already here and working. Again, these are all skilled people. We don't have that path for unskilled people or low-skilled people.
Thank you. Operator, do we have any other questions?
Yes, we do. We have a question from Camilo Montoya Galvez with NBC Universal.
Hi, everyone. Thank you for the conversation. Just wondering, has there been any analysis of how this new RACE Act would affect undocumented workers in the dairy farm industry specifically?
There's actually some discussion about the dairy industry in the paper, so it is a good question. It doesn't talk specifically about undocumented because obviously you would need a different set of different set of legislative initiatives to deal with them. You know, you couldn't just do it through the legal immigration system. But it is a real issue, and it was interesting what Craig said about how you don't want to rely just on a temporary visa program, and that employers, you know, would be happy to sponsor people for permanent residence, you know, so they could stay with and work long term and support their families. But it's not really available in the U.S. system, both obviously if the people are here in undocumented status, but also even in general, there's almost no slots for green cards. And in theory, generally can't even use temporary visas. They aren't really, it's not really a seasonal, you know, it's not really seasonal. You know, most of the work in dairy, for example, and there's other industries like that too, where it's really not seasonal. So it is an important issue, and there is some discussion there about dairy, and it really, and I think dairy industry is one of the examples of an industry that completely falls through the cracks of the U.S. immigration system.
And, you know, I would just add to what Stuart said. Under the RAISE Act, even if you did, as an employer, sponsor a dairy worker for an employment-based third preference category, and you were waiting in a long, long, long line to get your green card, under this proposal, if that green card was not available within a year, that dairy worker would be out of luck and would no longer have the ability to get a green card through the old system. So I think, you know, there's a lot that needs to be looked at from all different sectors, but I think you hit the nail on the head. Dairy and agriculture would be heavily harmed by this proposal.
And just to emphasize something that Laura said about people being removed from the immigration waiting list, there's somewhere between, there's over 4 million people now on family and employment-based immigration waiting lists. And even if one was to make a successful argument about changing aspects of the U.S. immigration system, there really does not seem to be any justification for completely removing from the waiting list, you know, removing people who've been waiting in line for many years and followed the practices that everyone claims that they support, where people are waiting legally to immigrate. It seems to me that's just a terrible government practice, and there really doesn't seem to be any justification, even if you were to change aspects of the legal immigration system.
And our last question today will come from Pablo Gutierrez from Telemundo NBC.
Hi, good afternoon. I just wanted to follow up on the dairy workers. I know that here in New York State, the dairy industry is heavily supported by undocumented workers. I think Craig mentioned that half or more of American agricultural workers are not legally authorized to work. So my question is, aside from what we already know about the RAISE Act and what it's attempting to do, are there any other types of legislation out there that are trying to solve this issue, in specific with the dairy industry?
Yeah, I think this is Craig. I'll take a stab at that. There are several legislative proposals that have been introduced in both the House and the Senate that would seek to make some modifications to the current H-2A program, and one of the more popular of those modifications is to allow the dairy industry access to the program. And in fact, Congressman Dan Newhouse from Eastern Washington State offered an amendment in the markup of an appropriations bill that would overcome the requirement that a job itself has to be temporary or seasonal to be filled by an H-2A worker. So there are several different proposals that are out there that I'd call them small ball proposals. They're all well intended, but they really don't get to the full solution that's needed. So we're not critical of them for what they are, but we look forward to the conversation broadening out to really the full range of solutions needed. And I'll just emphasize, I talk to a lot of dairy farmers, and most of them will say that they need a future visa program that they've got access to, but dealing constructively with the current workforce, which has gained tremendous skill and experience, and allowing unauthorized workers some mechanism to be able to earn work authorization and legal presence is absolutely critical.
And I'd now like to turn the call back to Jacinta for any additional or closing remarks.
Great. Thank you so much. I just wanted to thank all of our speakers today for joining us on the call, especially those who are joining us from their vacations, and to everyone else who joined as well. Our paper is available on our website at www.immigrationforum.org. Thank you so much.
And thank you very much. That does conclude our conference for today.